Books Network, the African American Studies category. Today I have with me author Michelle Kuo, the author of A Teacher, A Student, and A Life-Changing Friendship, Reading with Patrick. Hello and welcome, Michelle.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
So I'm intrigued to hear your story. You're an Asian American, and it's Black literature that taught you about American history. I'm also a teacher. I'm Black, and I learned through American history. So your story is very intriguing, and I'm sure it's the juxtaposition, one culture learning from another culture. So tell us more.
Thanks. And that means a lot coming from you. So I grew up, you know, in Western Michigan, where Asian Americans were very few. And it was the 1980s. Nobody used the phrase Asian American. My parents didn't. My school didn't. And I think that's, I wish I could just, you know, observe myself growing up, because I must have been confused and not known where I fit in. And it's really interesting to me that I was so drawn to African American literature. I read so much in high school. I read Civil Rights History, and Martin Luther King, then I read Malcolm X, and I read James Baldwin, Invisible Man, Zora Neale Hurston. And I didn't consciously understand that I was being drawn to books that articulated a racial consciousness. I didn't, you know, really understand that this was my way of asserting my Americanness by feeling close and passionate about African American history. I didn't understand that it came from this void of Asian American history. You know, I didn't read any Asian American writers growing up besides Joy Luck Club. And certainly there were no Asian heroes on television or stories of people from Taiwan, which is the country where my parents were from. It's so funny, you know, I mean, the only Asian person on TV was Connie Chung. And so there were all these, like, my mom would have me, like, prepare these little broadcasts, like, you know, just prepare a 5-minute broadcast, like I was some kind of person gearing up to be a TV broadcaster. But my point being that, you know, by the time I went to college, I thought of myself as being American through my connection through African American history. And I didn't really question that and start to search more of my immigrant and Taiwanese background until much later, until the past 5 years of my life, quite honestly, until when I was writing this book.
That makes sense. Because you, in the book, you pitch fearless Black American against a fearful Asian American. You know, so it's like you're, as Amy Tan would say, becoming Chinese. It wasn't, right, exactly. It would be different for you. So in this becoming Michelle. Yeah, exactly. Because that's what it is, really. Why do you, how did you see that? The fearless Black American and the fearful, because those are two opposite words.
Yeah, it's, you know, I love that you found that contrast, because it's so interesting how a person growing up uncertain of their identity often tends to react in opposition to other ideas. So I had a view, a stereotype of Asian Americans as being fearful, as not speaking up. And this is partly from societal perceptions, but it's also from, you know, it's also from immigrant parents who grew up in an authoritarian government in Taiwan, you know, in the 1950s and 60s. And there's no such thing as, you know, dissent and free speech, or there weren't professions like, you know, journalists or activists. So my parents did have a fearful attitude about what it meant to pursue different professions and to speak out. when I was reading Black literature, so many of these memoirs of African-American men and women were about finding a voice, about finding courage to speak out. And those were the stories that I grew up with. And because there were no stories of that happening for Asian Americans, in my mind, they were, you know, they were the powerful ones who were part of history, and we Asians were not part of history. And that binary is, I continue to believe in that binary, even when I go down to Arkansas to be a teacher. You know, I don't think of myself as a typical Asian American. I think of myself as reacting against the typical Asian American.
I really like the fact that you were so honest in the book about teaching, because teaching is hard. And in the chapter of the raisin and the sun, you really are upset, you know, with what's happening and how it's happening, and you're not happy with the standards. What happens when you unearth a raisin in the sun and it changes the student perspective, and it seems to have changed your teaching?
I love that you brought up raisin and sun and this moment of hope, basically, in a series of, you know, missteps and mistakes. It's so powerful when you find a text that students love. I thought that they would love all these other texts, powerful texts that I brought them. But Raisin and Son, they related to their grandma. The grandma is in Raisin and Son is this woman from Mississippi who is really religious, who is strict, who is loving, who is a pillar in the family. And the students, a lot of them recognize that grandma because a lot of them have been raised by grandmas that are similar. And the language was, they could feel how powerful and lyrical and real it was, you know? And then when they actually had roles to play, it brought out their creativity and their passions. I am so grateful to that book to Lorraine Hansberry for writing it. Teaching is so funny because sometimes all you need to do is just be a conduit and to find the text that the kid will love, you know? I mean, there's so many hard things about teaching, but there is an element of magic and matchmaking to it.
Yes, that there is, which you do again with, I enjoyed that, the I Am poem. I am, I feel, I wonder, I hear, I see, I understand, I say, I dream, I try, I hope, I want, I pretend, I cry. What a way to reach your students to have to answer those questions, right? So that also changed the dynamics of your classroom. Did you get everything you were hoping for?
Love that assignment because it's hard. Ask, you know, if you asked me to do it, I'd find it really hard to talk about what, you know, the poems like I Pretend, What Do You Wonder About? What, you know, it really asks people to admit to having an inner life, basically. And for especially kids who have been fed grammar sheets for most of their schooling, who haven't had access to arts and music programs, who haven't had access to mental health counselors, who often have experienced some traumatizing things either at school or in their neighborhood or at home, just to have a space where they are encouraged to share about themselves, and where the poem is better the more you share, right? And I think that fundamental idea of like your life is worth writing about, your life has dignity, I feel like that poem communicates that. And not everybody, you know, I was really careful. I didn't want people who were private to feel like they had to write. But then I would ask those people to write from the perspective of their mother or their grandmother or in one heartbreaking case, the point of view of his brother who had died. And those private students really opened up to that exercise because they viewed it as a way of honoring the people in their family and as a way to show off how much they could imagine themselves into the perspectives of others. I felt thrilled because after they worked on these poems, I took them all to Kinko's. I mean, I took all of the copies of the poems at Kinko's and blew them up to poster size and then put them all around the classroom along with their pictures so that when they walked into the classroom, they would feel that they owned the classroom, that it really belonged to them.
You're giving me a moment of the movie Freedom Riders with Hilary Swank. Have you ever seen that?
I actually haven't, and I want to. How is it?
It's absolutely you. Only the critics will say she's another white savior in the Black neighborhood, but you're not. That's the difference, you know. And the movie she does, she enters into this classroom with these students who all they know is fighting, you know, and she introduces them to this diary and gives them a voice. And when I hear what you have done with just this simple poem, Free Write, you know, this Free Write poem, I Am, it's amazing. You have, so it's a movie for you to watch, you know, one day when you get time, because if you're teaching now, there's really no extra time for movies.
You know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Like swamped in papers. Yep, I know. It's just like, I say paper grading is like never ending laundry. It just keeps on coming.
There's like no end.
What you do. No, exactly. So for the Christmas break, then you can watch it. But you will see yourself. You will see. And she takes the students and she does these amazing things with them, you know, and just like you blowing up their poem and placing it on the wall, making them feel so much better about themselves. When nobody else does. What I also like about your book, I love writing in notebooks, diaries, and journals. And on page 33, you begin to talk about your own notebook.
Yeah.
Your own notebook. And this is another thing that got me to Freedom Writers. I'm like, oh my goodness, she's now, you ask the children to be intimate and open, and then there you are very much doing the same thing. You know, I want to just read a little bit of this part because it says so much about you. My notebooks are strange, filled with often contradictory self-exhortations and resolutions. Be kind. Don't be afraid of to be mean. Sometimes the notes read as if I had joined a cult. Change is happening every day. No spiritual work is ever wasted. And there were notes that felt directly relevant. Work tirelessly. If, as you are going to sleep at night, you remember, I did not do what I ought to have done. Arise at once and do it. It's like you're on your own spiritual journey. That doesn't sound too quirky with your students and with this teaching.
Thank you so much. You're the first person who's ever brought up my own notebooks, and they are crazy looking. Just, you know, it's so interesting. I think there are moments, intense moments of our lives where we believe we can be perfect, you know, and it's not about saving other people. It's just about doing what we're meant to do on earth, which is to help people, you know, and to not lose sight of that and to not seek more frivolous, like escapist comforts. And usually these moments happen earlier in our lives when we will not accept less from ourselves, you know, and that was, those notebooks really capture that time in my life. I mean, I like to think I'm a little easier on myself now, but I also like that younger self that wouldn't be easy on herself, you know? I like all, the only thing that mattered and it was, the only thing that mattered was like to live up to what I was capable of doing. And I think I think about it now because, like, you know, my parents weren't aging at the time. I wasn't thinking about finding a partner or a family or anything. The only thing that mattered was being really good at my job.
And being really good at your job got you to law school. So I was reading and I'm like, she's applying to law school. She's going to leave the Kings. You know, this is how I'm feeling. She's going to leave. Is she going to get accepted? What's going to happen when she goes to law school? And it's amazing what happens when you go to law school. Does that win the relationship with Patrick? Tell us a little bit about Patrick.
Yeah. So Patrick is a 15-year-old kid who I met my second year of teaching. And he was really bright and quiet. He took to silent reading immediately. He broke up fights. Like, I saw him jump in between these two girls who were fighting, and he got knocked to the ground when that happened. He wasn't a kid who fought, you know. He just wasn't. It wasn't his personality. He was a kid who wanted to learn. He had one major problem that was attendance. He, like, just didn't come to school sometimes. So I was, like, really, you know, gung-ho. I just, like, would go to his house and be like, hey, why didn't you come to school? And miraculously, he would just start to come because an adult had asked him. So he started to do really well in my class. He started to come every day, and he got this most improved award at the end of the year. He was in eighth grade because he had been held back a couple of years in the past. At the same time, I was applying to law school. I'm, like, not proud of it. I know that there are huge polarizing teacher debates about Teach for America as a program and whether it creates more turnover. But I will say that, you know, I wouldn't have considered teaching if it hadn't been for the program, and that I wanted to stay longer. And there are many amazing teachers who come through that program who have stayed in the Delta, who have stayed as teachers. I wasn't one of them. And I was really embarrassed about writing the book because I knew it would look like, I don't know. I just didn't like how it looked, or maybe how it is, just to leave teaching, to leave the Delta and go take this more conventional route. But I also wanted to put that kind of humanness and disappointing quality of myself, like, on the page, you know, because that's just what's real. And I went to law school. That's when I found out, 3 years when I was about to graduate, that Patrick had gotten into a fight and killed someone. And I was totally devastated. I didn't believe it because Patrick just wasn't a kid who got into a fight. I didn't understand that if you grow up in a poor neighborhood, of course you can get swallowed up and sucked in. You know, you have to fight. You have to spiritually fight really hard to stay out of it. And so after I graduated from law school, I went back to see him and to see how he was doing.
I applauded you for that. I did. I was reading and I said, this is completely awesome. That was, and then you guys developed a relationship, and there you teach Patrick some. I don't want to give it away. I want the people to pick up the book and read it and find out how this relationship builds and what you teach Patrick, you know, as well as yourself. I love the, I think the book is extraordinary. It has a lot of great teaching techniques. It has a lot of history about it.
Thank you so much.
It has a lot of humanness in it. And what I will ask you is, how does reading with Patrick fit into African-American studies?
It's so interesting because there's a really straightforward way in which it fits in. It's about the rural South. It's about the people who stayed behind, who were left behind. We hear more and more about the Great Migration and the 6 million African Americans who moved west and north, but we hear less often about those who weren't able to leave. Often, not always, but often they tend to be people with fewer resources and fewer contacts with the outside world. And the Delta today is still majority Black. still poor, still segregated, and the people are the descendants of those who didn't make it out during the Great Migration. Some of them are people who went and then came back because they were disappointed, but many others are, you know, those who stayed behind. So in this really straightforward way, it's about the descendants of slaves and sharecroppers who still live in the rural South, you know, and how they live, criminal justice and education there. But I guess in a way that's more personal, it's about interracial bonds and relationships. It's about attempts at interracial solidarity. Like, we so rarely see an Asian American and an African American in the same room. And there are all of these juxtapositions that we create and then we then have to collapse. So I set them up in the book, and you so insightfully pointed them out, you know, that the fearful Asian versus the fearless African-American hero. Another is the voluntary immigrant's child versus the involuntary migrant's descendant, you know, and the relationship of immigrants to African Americans, which is such a poignant and painful one. Because when my parents came to visit me in this middle of nowhere town in Arkansas that, you know, had no coffee shop and had all these boarded up houses, they were so afraid. They were just like, "What are you? Why are you here? We left Taiwan and we came to this country so that you wouldn't have to live in a place like this. Like, this is the kind of place we would leave." And just the idea of the identity of an immigrant as being somebody, of my parents as being people who leave and climb higher, you know, and then the identity of somebody like Patrick, who has to learn about the history of slavery and violence. I think I'm really interested in how African American studies is becoming more and more institutional, which is good, right? It's something that people had to fight for 40 years ago, and now it's part of an institution. But what that also means is that people grow up, everybody grows up with a sense of African-American history's relationship to the U.S. and African-Americans' role, you know, the original sin of slavery. And I think when you place an Asian-American interlocutor in that story, it's really interesting to think about what doesn't get canonized, you know. I feel like I'm rambling here, Angela. I don't know if am I making sense. Yeah. maybe I haven't quite figured it out. I'm like, oh, I'm trying to figure out what I was trying to figure out is like just to talk more. Just like, why? I guess what I was trying to say is that when I was growing up, some African American literature was just starting to be canonized, and there was no Asian American literature at all. And that there was something weirdly liberating about not having any, like, it was wrong, but it's also liberating about not having any Asian American history at all, because I could find myself in so many different things, you know? And then in my classroom, when I was teaching, you know, I was a product of, you know, like a progressive education. I was trying to force all of this African American literature into my students without like recognizing that they were so individual in their needs. Some people wanted it, liked it, thirsted after it, but other people wanted to read about Japanese haikus or a kung fu novel or about the world. And I forgot that was a fundamental freedom that they had. And that was actually weirdly the freedom that I had when I was growing up, because there was no Asian American history at all. I'm not advocating that we not have Asian American history, but I'm just saying that like, sometimes we forget how individual and mysterious each person is. And that's like partly what I discovered as a teacher, which is really counterintuitive. It's counterintuitive because we want to be so progressive and respectful towards like the African-American canon. Does that make sense?
Right.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense, because when I'm teaching, I always try to make, especially when it's literature, I always try to make a, or even if it's writing, I always try to make us go around the world. And therefore, I always find myself with Amy Tan's mother tongue so we can see the difficulties that she has. And then we might go to a Malcolm X autobiography, you know, so that we can begin to weave the cultures that we can, what we try to say is it doesn't really matter what culture we have. We all have this shared experience, you know? And so I understand what, how you see it. Like if there's no canon, and now really there has been canon. I mean, Amy Tan is canonized. Ha Jen is canonized, you know, Maxine Kong, that's it, Maxine. And there's another lady, she's a poet and her name is not coming to me at this moment. And so, yeah, so now the dynamics change. So you've entered, yeah, so you've entered a great world and you made a great space, you know, for yourself to teach and see things differently. And not only did Patrick learn, but Michelle learned. Exactly. I think it was great. Oh, this was a wonderful. This was wonderful. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, because I know what it's like when you're teaching and scheduling in between.
Oh my gosh.
It's crazy, right? I know.
Yeah. Are you kidding, though? Thank you for reading my book so insightfully and warmly and generously, and then for taking the time to talk to me about it. I'm the one who's really grateful.
Indeed, I enjoyed this. I'm hoping to take a few parts of your book and incorporate it into my syllabus.
Oh, that's so nice.
Which speaks volumes. So you have a great day and an excellent Thanksgiving. I'm going to stop this from recording.